Hello, and welcome to Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. My name is Taylor, and I will be one of your hosts. Joining me here in a few seconds will be Tanner. But first, we have a few Patreon shout-outs to do. We want to say thank you to Jake, Robert, and Billy for joining us on Patreon. We greatly appreciate it and hope you enjoy all of that bonus content over there. With that done, let's bring in Tanner. Tanner, how you doing?
I'm doing really, really well.
Awesome. It feels good to be here doing this. It's been a minute.
I was saying, it's kind of weird to hear your voice on the intro.
Yeah. A lot's changed. We'll talk about that in a minute.
It's a different world.
What have you been up to? What have you been doing?
Well, you know, a lot of social media stuff just because of what's going on in Gaza and in the West Bank. But can't do that wall-to-wall 24/7.
No, so, that is unhealthy.
aside from that, a couple weeks ago, a band I really like called the Rural Alberta Advantage, they put out a new album called The Rise and the Fall.
Nice.
So I've been enjoying that. I like when a band puts out a new album and it kind of sparks you to go back and listen to their old catalog, and it just kind of reinvigorates your love for a band. So I've been really enjoying that.
Yeah, it's like when we release a good episode and then everyone goes back and listens to all of our old episodes. You should do that, everybody.
Since I did buy that album on Bandcamp, should mention, don't have time to go into the details here, but obviously in the past few weeks, the Bandcamp situation, you know, they were sold from Epic to another company called SongTrader, who has already gutted the employment levels there. I think they fired about half of the people there. That's a developing situation to see what exactly is going to happen with Bandcamp.
Yeah, it definitely sounded like, I've never used Bandcamp and don't know anything about it, but everyone that does use it seems really disappointed that it was a great service that isn't going to exist in the same way.
It's the perennial evil of capitalism. It always has to be growing and changing and being dynamic when you could just make a good product that provides an outlet for bands that don't traditionally have as big of a reach. So if you do use Bandcamp and you somehow have not seen that news, go ahead and download your Bandcamp collection, to a hard drive or something so that you can make sure you still have access to that. I know some people are exploring some other replacement avenues for that. Also, finally listened to season 3 of Blowback.
Nice.
I had really enjoyed the first two seasons of that on the invasion of Iraq and Cuba. So finally listened to season 3 on the Korean War. And it led me to the book, The Bridge at Nogun Ri, by Charles Hanley, Sang-hun Cho, and Martha Mendoza. It's an account of a massacre of Korean civilians at the hands of U.S. troops. The 7th Cavalry, actually.
Mm.
And the authors actually won a Pulitzer for this reporting in 2000.
Interesting.
And why that story really grabbed me, they spent, on the podcast, they spent a good chunk of an episode talking about this. And I had literally never heard of this before.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, there's most of the Korean War I'd never heard of before. I think going into that, I probably only knew about Chosin Reservoir and the landing at Incheon.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, like almost every other aspect of the Korean War, this massacre at Nogun Ri, it's an event that goes unremembered for Americans, which is interesting because it really does highlight the contrasts in what we know collectively about, say, Vietnam versus Korea. Most people with even like a basic moderate knowledge of American history know about the My Lai massacre. During the Vietnam War. Not the only instance of targeting civilians, but definitely the most infamous.
I just finished Max Hastings' Korean War book, and like they definitely talk about this, but it's not in any sort of like detailed account.
It's kind of like with shipwrecks, where you find one and you're like, how have I never heard of this before? Mm-hmm. And this is simply just because of, you know, when and where it happened in the context that we just don't get a lot of exposure to what actually happened in Korea. And how terrible of a war it really was.
Yeah, that's what stood out to me reading the Hastings book was we don't talk about this war, but like it was brutal on all sides.
It was interesting to learn about, you know, especially right now at a time when the U.S. continues to facilitate the killing of civilians. It's a somewhat timely read, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
How about you? What have you been up to?
Well, we'll start small and get big. I finished that Korean War book by Max Hastings. It was good. It was a pretty high overview of everything, but he does a good job of picking out individual stories. Obviously, it and he even acknowledges like it's a pretty Western view of it, but he does actually have a lot of Korean and Chinese sources too. So it's good. It's an older book. I think it's from like the 90s. So some of the geopolitical talk of the future is interesting to hear what the attitudes were in like 1994.
That's actually interesting because I recently finished reading Michael Parenti's Against Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote that in 1995. And the prescience of that book, the stuff he talks about, the growing problems around the world and potential flashpoints, and how they're new problems, but they're old problems. It's following the same script, the same playbook. Truly an amazing read because of how applicable it still is to today. So same idea here.
So with finishing that, I started a new book called Masters of the Air by Donald L. Miller. It's a look at like the American bomber crews in like 1943 and 1944 in Europe. And like, that's not something I'd ever really like. I mean, obviously, as a kid, I loved planes and going to the Air Force Museum, things like that. But reading like the actual accounts of what it was like is very different. Like just how brutal that environment was. You're freezing cold. You'll pass out if you don't wear an oxygen mask. By the way, there's like shells exploding in your aircraft. So like at the end of all of these missions, like the inside of these planes are just covered in blood and gunpowder and metal. And I mean, any kind of bodily fluid you can think of. Like it was a brutal environment. It was interesting reading how psychological things were. Like Catch 22 is so much more real than like we'd want to admit that, you know, Joseph Heller like went through those things, because they were saying that, you know, a lot of times you'd sit in the plane for an hour and a half to go on a mission, and then they'd be like, oh, mission's canceled. Never mind. Everyone get out. And like, you can't keep doing that cycle of like up and down over mm-hmm. and over. So it's a very interesting book. It also deals with the things of like targeting civilians. Like that, there was much more of a debate about that than I think we probably talk about. We just take for granted like bombing Dresden or something, but like a lot of people had a lot of objections to that kind of stuff. It wasn't just like bomb, bomb, bomb. It's mm-hmm. very, you don't hear about the debate nowadays, I don't feel like.
Obviously, that's been a big topic of discussion also recently is, you know, the role of civilians in a conflict zone. But yeah, like you mentioned with like how World War II is kind of like the first like large scale explicit targeting of civilian areas.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, civilians are always going to get caught up in a war, but like that's the first time that we have the wherewithal like technologically to actually devastate civilian areas.
Yeah, it's very much like that total war idea of, you know, like the march through Georgia of, I don't have to destroy the factory. I just have to destroy the worker's house so they can't go to the factory. So it is very interesting. It's interesting to see that in that book. But Donald L. Miller does a good job. It's very he does a good job relating it to individual people.
That's interesting, especially like the internal side, because like I think everything involving air combat and the aerial war, a lot of it is so sanitized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your average person's conception, because the distances are greater.
Well, it's like very much by design, it got sanitized, like is what, you know.
And so it's harder to even conceptualize, you know, it seems like they're not killing people in the same way that, you know, mm-hmm. An artillery shell or a gun would. But it's like they are and in larger numbers.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So I'm probably a third of the way through that. And like, I highly recommend that. Other news. We'll put these two together. I got married, as we've
that's
mentioned.
That's good. That's good.
You were there for that. That was fun. I got to, you know, got to see everybody and hang out. That was a really fun time. Yeah, it was great. Right after that, we went to Hawaii. And the Big Island of Hawaii might be my favorite place I've ever been. It was just different than I thought it would be. Like, there's obviously some resorts and things like that, but we stayed out kind of just in the country, I guess you'd call it. And it was just great. Like, it was a great experience, like getting to just meet regular people and kind of like experience the real Big Island rather than just like sipping a Mai Tai at a resort. That didn't really do it for me.
Yeah.
It was great. I mean, seeing Mount Kilauea, the coolest part is just driving from the top of the crater down to the ocean over the course of like 15 miles. I don't know. There were some definitely cool experiences and everything. So that is, it is something that I was really grateful we got the chance to do. As far as like the Big Island goes, the only way I can describe it is like a tropical West Virginia in like the best ways possible.
Amazing.
like you would be driving and like there's just houses on the side of a hill just perched there, and there's chickens and pigs running around, there's goats all just running loose. The only way I can describe it is a tropical West Virginia.
It sounds beautiful.
Yeah, it was. Like, it's just some of the most beautiful scenery that there ever has been created, I do believe.
Hope it doesn't spur a wave of white people to hear how great it is. And
I know.
Let's all move to Hawaii.
I kept thinking, like, God, I understand why people do this, but, like, I don't think they need another one of me here. Yeah, I get it. It was cool seeing, like, we actually stayed in Captain Cook, the name of the little town we were in. But it was interesting seeing, like, the Captain Cook marker and everything and where he met his fate. So there was just so much interesting history and stuff like that.
Chalk outline in the sand.
yeah, right? I'll do that with a Snapchat filter. So yeah, that was our big trip. It was a lot of fun. Hawaii is amazing. One other thing I get to announce is we have a podcast goat now.
Something that probably not many podcasts have. What is our goat's name?
Gadget the Goat.
Gadget.
We visited a place called the Big Island Animal Sanctuary while we were there on the Big Island, and it was absolutely awesome. Like, we got to pet pigs, goats, cows, all kinds of stuff. The woman who runs it is really cool. We're actually Instagram friends now with the podcast, so I'll post some links to her stuff as well so we can maybe support her a little bit in her mission. So it was really cool. But yeah, Gadget the Goat, I will post a link to Gadget's bio. And yeah, it's our podcast goat. Just like every Navy ship, we have to have a goat.
Did you go to Pearl Harbor?
Yes.
Speaking of Navy ships.
Yeah. That's what's crazy. It's been a whole week there, and like that was one day of it spent there in Pearl Harbor and seeing things on that island, and it was cool. Pearl Harbor was very interesting, like kind of surreal. In the sense that, like, I've been interested in that since I was 5 years old and seeing the pictures, like going out to the Arizona Memorial and everything, like it was one of those things that definitely like met the expectation of what it would be. It like the, I guess the only places I've been like that, like it visiting the World Trade Center site or maybe like the Vietnam Memorial, like it has that same sort of air about it.
When you were visiting Pearl Harbor, did you have to like call ahead and set something up, or was it more of a surprise attack?
Just one Torah. It was pre-planned.
Danny, what the hell is that noise? You guys doing target practice or something?
I think World War II just started.
They don't like surprises there. But yeah, that was a cool trip. It was awesome. Cannot recommend it enough. If you want to have like a more real experience, I should say, like the Big Island is awesome. Like, you can have the resort stuff and the chain restaurants. There was an Outback Steakhouse, I think. I don't know. But you can also just go kind of make your own way and find stuff. And that's where we had a lot of fun. We did so much driving around that place. So that is what I've been up to. That's why I've been gone for like a month from the show. So I'm back. Sorry.
Yeah, we've kept it together. We've released, I think, a couple old bonus episodes. Nick and I recorded what became a two-part series about the Hunley. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I've enjoyed that Hunley series. It's great, Tom, getting to experience with the listeners, not knowing what my own podcast is going to put out all the time. It's like, hey, I get to listen to.
And then also we did release part two of the episode on the Santo Cristo de Burgos. That was kind of a long release process because we had a lot of content to go through and edit and get down, but that was released. So for anyone who hasn't checked that out, definitely check out that interview with Craig, who's done a lot of cool work with the wreck.
Yeah, and I guess the one other thing I've done, the only bit of podcast work I've done lately, is our Naughty Yachties series with Darcy. So we will be watching more of that. I think we have one more episode to watch before we put out a new episode of the podcast. So be on the lookout at that $5 Patreon tier. It's fun.
I was thinking about the name of that series and realizing that, like, for some people, the name rhymes and some it doesn't.
Yeah.
Someone from, like, the upper Midwest would say, like, Naughty Yachties. Uh-huh. And then someone from, like, Pittsburgh would call it, like, Naughty Yachties.
Uh-huh.
But for a lot of people, that it doesn't quite rhyme.
Yeah, it definitely is meant to be said with, like, a New England accent or something, I think.
But yeah, that's cool. We've got a lot of cool bonus stuff coming out now that we should be able to get on a more normal recording schedule.
Yeah, yeah. My shift at work will be in the daytime now. So that'll also be fun. We have a lot more opportunities to record. No more night work for me.
I guess one thing to just throw in here, we do have a current event update, and that is on the St. Lawrence Seaway workers strike. So I've been following this the last few days in the lead up to this. So I'm going to quote here from a post on the website of Unifor, the union that represents the St. Lawrence Seaway workers. On Saturday night, just before midnight, St. Lawrence Seaway workers made the difficult decision to go on strike after negotiations failed to reach a satisfactory agreement. Unifor National President Lana Payne expressed her disappointment in the failure of the employer to make serious movement in the past 2 days, saying, "This impasse is extremely unfortunate, but our members remain committed to getting a fair agreement." 72-hour strike notice was officially filed on October 18th, and despite sustained negotiating efforts, no resolution was reached by Saturday, October 21st at 11:59 p.m. Unifor Quebec Director Daniel... since this is Quebec, I'm going to assume he says this, Cloutier, emphasized the negotiating committee's ongoing commitment to constructive dialogue and said, "We negotiated in good faith right up to the last moment, but we cannot allow workers' rights to be compromised. We remain open to discussion and hope that the employer will reconsider its position for the good of all." Unifor is Canada's largest union in the private sector and represents 315,000 workers in every major area of the economy. The union advocates for all working people and their rights, fights for equality and social justice in Canada and abroad, and strives to create progressive change for a better future.
A French-Canadian union.
You know there's some good political discussions going on there.
I can only imagine. It might make horseshoe theory real. Who knows?
In another article from Toronto City News, Cloutier is quoted saying, "These are jobs that require intense training, a high level of understanding of the health and safety risks, and that carry enormous responsibility for the well-being of seafarers and their cargo. They are irreplaceable." Definitely wanted to mention this, I mean, just because it's so recent. It's not a huge news story anywhere. You know, there's other stuff in the world that's rightfully distracting everyone's attention. But I think also, just in general, people don't really realize how much North America relies on shipping through the St. Lawrence Seaway.
Yeah, I think a lot of people think of like the West Coast ports with stuff coming over from Asia, maybe some of the bigger East Coast ports. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff that flows through these middle ports.
I've seen comments on, you know, the news articles talking about the strike with people being like, "Well, good, replace them with trucks and trains." And it's like, dude, you have no concept of how much you can get on a ship.
Yeah, I think for things like grain or iron ore, like the economies of scale of moving that in a lake boat are just... trains don't get it. Certainly trucks don't get it.
You're not replacing this with a fleet of semi trucks. So again, from Toronto City News, just for some context, last year, some $16.7 billion worth of cargo, nearly half of it grain and iron ore, traversed the St. Lawrence Seaway, a system of locks, canals, and channels that stretches more than 300 kilometers. All that tells me that should probably pay them some money.
Yeah, like I'm okay with those guys getting paid. I feel like they're producing quite a bit of value there.
Yeah, so solidarity with St. Lawrence Seaway workers.
Also, though, like,
get that bag.
It's not even about the money all the time. So a lot of times it is about safety, time off, things like that. You know, like a lot of people probably are fairly paid, but when you're having to work 80 hours a week and work in unsafe conditions, it doesn't matter what you get paid.
Yeah, and this one is primarily over wages. I'm sure there's other stuff built in there too, but I think also with the recent union activity with the auto workers and you know, also talking about like Hollywood, the writer strike, that's maybe a bit more distant in terms of the industry, but you are kind of seeing a wave across fields and industries here of negotiation and, you know, when it comes down to it, strike action. So hopefully for all of our sakes, that can get worked out soon in a way that is favorable and fair to the employees.
Ready to talk about a time when employees didn't have as many rights?
For all the people who complain about unions, let's go back to a time before they existed or before they maybe had as much power.
All right. For this story, we're going to go back to 1929. We will be discussing the MV Material Service. Pretty interesting little vessel. All right, so in 1929, the MV Material Service is built by Latham D. Smith Shipbuilding and Dry Dock Company in Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. So not too far from you.
Yeah, that's only about an hour from me.
So by this point, Latham Smith is already known for a major innovation in Great Lakes shipping, the tunnel scraper system. Nice. Patents it in the 1920s, and this is a self-unloading process. Probably, you know, not really that different than what we're familiar with today, you know, in self-unloaders that, you know, you can go to smaller ports that may not have the same unloading facilities. It's cheaper, it's more efficient, and, you know, it's possible to convert old ships into using the system, which I imagine plays a big role in making this become a thing.
I was kind of reading about this, looking at like what this system replaced. Mm-hmm. And just like your regular conveyor belts just being, you know, loaded by people. Mm-hmm. And just how much more work that sounds like.
Yeah, it's just a much more physical process. So installing the system was about half the cost of building a new ship. So again, that helps, you know, get that to be a more standard adopted piece of equipment. And this innovation would change unloading times from a matter of days to a matter of hours. So really everybody wins. The crew has to do less work. The company can maybe squeeze out another voyage now that they're saving so much time. Because of this, being equipped on 14 of Latham's ships, this is actually what allows them to make it through the Great Depression. It's always interesting companies this time about the winners and losers in that. And, you know, a lot of times it's that competitive advantage. And in this case, that looks like what happened. Then another factor in the company's survival was the expansion of the Latham D. Smith Stone Quarry. And that made the company one of the largest stone producers on the lake. So diversity of business is probably also a good thing.
Yeah, I guess at this point, depression, if you got all your money in one thing, you're probably getting wiped out.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Also, I guess stone is probably something that people need like all the time.
Yeah. I mean, building material is somewhat evergreen, I suppose. I mean, you're still going to have government projects and stuff. I'm sure in Chicago, you could find someone to buy your stone. So the material service, it ends up actually being owned by Latham Smith and Putnam Navigation Company. So again, just another arm of this Latham Smith empire is the owner. She's built for $350,000. And another way that this company makes money is by leasing out their equipment. So they would sign a 10-year lease with Material Service Corporation based out of Chicago, Illinois, hence the name of the vessel, Material Service. Material Service is interesting because it is actually owned by another titan of industry, Henry Crown, who's not a name I know of, but he was a millionaire/billionaire in Chicago in the 1920s and 30s. So you just know he did horrible things to get where he was.
That guy's mobbed up, right?
Yeah, like he definitely, I don't know who he associated with, but like he wasn't doing this on his own.
A gravel company in 1920s Chicago.
Uh-huh. He would make his fortune by selling gravel, lime, and coal to Chicago area builders. So yeah, just absolutely mobbed up.
Also, for anyone who's listening in the greater Chicago area, we were trying to establish if Henry Crown has any connection to Robert Crown of the Robert Crown Sexual Education Center.
If you know, you know.
We weren't able to establish a connection, but if there is one, we would love to know.
So eventually, Crown would even have a controlling interest in General Dynamics, and he would merge that with Material Service Corporation. So just some big evil corporations.
What does General Dynamics do?
Is that like a little bit of everything?
Is that like just a weapons thing?
Amongst other things, I think it's just one of those conglomerates that does a lot of different things.
General, yeah, that's like one of those company names where I hear it and I can't immediately tell, is this a real company or is this from Fallout?
Yeah, right. Yeah, they definitely have the Fallout vibe. So a little bit more about the ship. She is a canal-sized work barge. So she's got twin engines, twin rudders. She's made to be maneuverable in canals or in the Chicago River. She sits really low in the water like a barge. So she looks sort of whaleback-esque, especially when she's loaded. She rides extremely low in the water. She's 240 feet long with a 40-foot beam and a draft of 13 feet 9 inches. Despite her strange looks, she actually does have a full crew area, and she's not just a barge. You know, a lot of these barges, you know, a barge is going to be pushed by a tug or something else. This is fully capable of operating on its own. She was equipped with self-unloading machinery, kind of as we've talked about before, and this included a collapsible A-frame. This allowed her to pass under Chicago's many bridges.
Oh, no.
So she is like a very specifically made piece of equipment. And what's fun to think is she probably went under the bridge that Dave Matthews Band dumped all that human waste out of.
I hope she had a canopy or something.
You know what she didn't have? Tarps on her hatch covers. We'll get there.
Oh, nice.
She was primarily tasked with moving bulk cargo, such as sand, gravel, limestone, all the things your favorite mobbed up materials guy would have. As you might imagine, this vessel was involved in some interesting incidents throughout her career. You know, we always, any ship that operates for a few years has always got stories of collisions or a fire, things like that. But as you can imagine, being owned by a billionaire in the 1920s, there were some unsavory characters about. In one attempt by rivals to sabotage the Material Service Corporation and the Material Service herself, she was rocked by an explosion on November 30th, 1930. This resulted in the death of one man and several injuries. No definitive answer was ever found, but the general consensus is that dynamite was smuggled aboard. Although damaged, she would not sink and soon be back in action. Very interesting. This straight up feels like some mob stuff.
So while that's possible, the dynamite option, as we've learned from the Gaza Strip, when something explodes, there's always two stories about it. So we have the same thing here. There's actually a court case, Latham Smith Putnam Navigation Company versus Osby. And this was in, I believe, 1935.
I've intercepted a radio call between
two mob operatives talking about accidentally leaving a stick of dynamite on the barge. So members of the crew filed lawsuits against the company seeking damages for injuries resulting from the explosion. Rather than the dynamite theory, which I don't know the specifics of it, but it seems like maybe that was what was advanced by the company, saying, well, our rivals are trying to sabotage us.
It's probably also what sold newspapers.
Yeah. The crew had a different theory. The crew members charged that the ship's owners had, quote, permitted the vessel to become and remain defective in many particulars and to be unsafe so that explosive gases and fumes accumulated in dangerous quantities. And that, quote, by reason of the said negligence, the gases exploded, causing the injuries sustained by the appellees. So as you mentioned, the cause of the explosion was never conclusively proven. However, what they were able to prove was evidence of neglect on the part of the owners, which will be important for the court decision. So the court documents detail that the explosion happened in the steering gear room at the extreme aft section of the main deck. Quote, under the main deck and beneath the steering gear room, in various other rooms mentioned, was a water ballast tank known as the afterpeak tank. Through this afterpeak tank ran the captain's toilet soil pipe, which vented outside the hull.
Plumbing here! Plumbing! Yes, citizens, plumbing! It's the latest invention to hit Rome! It moves water from one place to another. It's astounding. It's amazing. Get on the bandwagon. Pipe the shit right out of your house.
Various witnesses testified there were strong odors in the tank and in the steering gear room. So the captain's toilet pipe is apparently leaking into this ballast room. So odors were also noted in the dining area, leading to the discovery of a 2-inch hole in the soil pipe. So this was apparently patched up and the tank was washed out, but that wasn't the extent of the grossness going on here. This is a direct quote from the court decision. The evidence, though disputed, justified the finding of the court that the tank was filled with water at Bubbly Creek.
Ew.
You're going to find out why it's called Bubbly Creek here.
Uh-huh. Some Upton Sinclair stuff right here.
The water there is thoroughly permeated by sewage from the stockyards and contains putrefying animal matter. Great bubbles of gas arise from the fermentation of the same at the bottom.
Everything we do in Chicago is gross.
Why is it always human waste in Chicago? This is the worst part. It was said that the water was so thick that rats could run across it, that it clogged the seacocks, and that it became necessary to use compressed air to clear them out.
That's the worst.
You've got to clean the water out with compressed air because it's so viscous. This is like if you dropped a match in this water, it would catch on fire, probably.
Yeah, there's some pictures. I've read about
Cuyahoga River stuff.
I've read about Bubbly Creek before. There's some pictures you can find on the internet, and it's just insane what it looks like.
So all of that saying that the sewage solids in the water, they led to the buildup of methane gas. Claimants allege that the air mixture in the steering gear room would reach as high as 14.4% methane.
Good Lord.
Where a level of 5% could cause an explosion. Additional concerns about the buildup of carbon monoxide indicated these gases as the cause of the explosion, which, quote, would not have occurred in the ordinary course of events. And why that's important is the basis for the decision that's made here. And this court case actually ends up being precedent in, I think, like 9 later cases. So using this principle of res ipsa loquitur, which means basically the thing speaks for itself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quoting here from Cornell Law School. In tort law, a principle that allows plaintiffs to meet their burden of proof with what is, in effect, circumstantial evidence. The plaintiff can create a rebuttable presumption of negligence by the defendant by proving that the harm would not ordinarily have occurred without negligence, that the object that caused the harm was under the defendant's control, and that there are no other plausible explanations.
So pretty much saying, like, this thing wouldn't happen if there hadn't been neglect, basically.
From the way I understand it in my non-legal brain is that even if you don't necessarily prove how something happened, saying this is what directly led to the explosion, saying the explosion could not have happened without this buildup of methane gas that the company allowed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of on its own, that circumstantial evidence that might not normally be permissible, in this case it would be, because there's no, if you took that negligence out, there's no explosion.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
The company attempted to argue that they did not have exclusive control of the vessel, saying that, you know, they're not solely responsible for the conditions on board, you know, because they're not operating it all the time. It's the crew who are doing that. The court found no showing of contributory negligence upon the part of any of the appellees.
Interesting.
So I wasn't able to find like what the actual settlement was for or like what money got paid out. But it seems like the findings were all in favor of the crew.
This has like it has like all the reading of like, yeah, we'll find in favor of the crew. And like, here's your like $1 settlement.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's very possible at this time. I'm sure like the negotiating position of the crew is probably not very good. So the company can probably get away with paying a pittance you know, in 1935. But I don't know. That's after like the New Deal has started and everything.
That's so true.
I don't know.
Well, all of that is a great lead in to January 28th, 1936. Material service is getting underway from Lockport, Illinois, running down to Calumet Harbor in Indiana. It's a really short trip. She's got a load of sand, so this is normal. It's like 5 or 6 miles for like those unfamiliar with the area. Like, we're not talking a very far distance. She's not really made to be out in the open lake. So this is all she's really supposed to do is just go from like point to point like this. So around midnight, weather conditions begin to deteriorate.
Does that feel good? Feel good saying that again?
Yeah, it feels really good saying that. Waves begin to kick up. And while this is going on, Captain Brown is actually the one on duty. His reaction, though, is to be like, hey, we don't have far to go. We're not going to do all this work. We're not going to put the tarps on the hatch covers and make them waterproof. Why would we do that? That's not a thing we need to do.
I'm sorry. The vessel that is constantly leaking noxious sewage gas is captained by a guy named Captain Brown.
Yes. But also, see, if you want that gas to escape, you can't make the hatches watertight.
You gotta leave them open.
So you really have to pick which one you want to deal with. So he makes a decision not to waterproof the hatches, or water resist the hatches, I guess is probably the better way to say it. Around 1 a.m. on July 28th, the vessel's third assistant engineer notices about 2 feet of water in the ship's engine room bilge. That's not good.
And like, again, knowing what we know about this ship, water accumulating in the bottom of this thing is probably not very clean.
Right. So the engineer starts both bilge pumps in an attempt to clear the water. Suddenly, just as the second pump came to life, the vessel shuddered hard to port and water quickly swept over her deck. All of this happened as most of the crew was below decks and in their bunks. Due to her unique design, it was basically impossible for some of these men to get out once this happened. Once she shuddered and started to go under quickly, you were basically trapped in some of these rooms.
Especially if you've already been knocked out by the carbon monoxide.
Yeah. So 11 men were able to get free of the hull. However, four of them would be sucked down as the barge sank. All told, these events took place in about the span of 1 minute. Like, you had about 1 minute to get out of your bunk, get up top, and get off. And get clear of the sinking vessel. Pretty quickly, because they're so close. They're extremely close to shore. I think they're like 8,000 feet off of the shore when this is going on. The Coast Guard is able to arrive on scene pretty quickly. But by the time they arrive, all that's visible is the collapsible A-frame and a bow light staff that are above the water. That's how quickly this vessel goes down. Kind of, again, like a whaleback, it doesn't look like it wants to float. It just doesn't. These responders, though, they're from the Calumet Life Saving Station. They would end up picking up four men. The Tug New Jersey would pick up two more. And one man would actually swim from the sinking vessel to the Calumet Lighthouse. That's how close all of this was going down. In total, 15 men would be lost in the sinking.
So is it a total of like, what is it, like 26 people on board? Or no, that's not right. My math isn't right there.
22.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, 15 men would not survive out of that 22. So, I mean, obviously, when these things happen so suddenly, like, this is kind of what you'd expect at this point, I feel like. And knowing all of these maintenance deficiencies, I can imagine the life-saving equipment is also not up to par.
Mm-hmm.
So, honestly, probably pretty lucky to survive this one if you were in the right place at the right time. So, almost immediately, there's controversy surrounding this accident, and there's plenty of theories surrounding it. Material Services owners supported the idea that the vessel was caught in a trough between two waves and slammed into Calumet Shoals. This would have ruptured her steel plates, resulting in massive catastrophic flooding. That makes sense, right? Like, I mean, the idea behind it makes sense. However, there may be a little bit more to it. That very well could have happened, but there might have been more going on that would have caused it to happen or put the ship in a bad place. The official theory of the investigation was that Captain Charles D. Brown, Charlie Brown himself, failed to order the tarps on the hatch covers.
Good grief.
The Great Lakes and hatch covers, it's just a match made for seeing heaven. I just feel like we go back to hatch covers so often on the Great Lakes.
Close them. Just close them.
Just seal them off with some tarps and get to Calumet Harbor.
I don't care what it smells like in there. Just yeah, close right. them.
This has been the generally accepted theory as to why the vessel went down. And it makes sense. It's why it would suddenly lose buoyancy and just go, right? It's a pretty common story, I think, in these losses. So 3 days after the vessel went down, divers are able to recover 9 of the 15 bodies from the wreck and its surrounding area. Eventually, they would recover 13 of the 15 people who were lost in this incident. Again, it just seems like the worst job ever, being a scuba diver who has to recover bodies. No, thank you. I don't want to recover bodies on land. I know I don't want to do it in the water.
I assume at this point, diving suits have progressed from like the old metal ones a little bit.
Yeah, I would assume. I don't know what 1930s diving tech. I imagine there's still a lot of metal. So over the next few decades, multiple attempts would be made at salvage. A Canadian company would attempt to salvage it in the 1940s, and they would actually do this for about 2 years with no success. They would then sell this to a man in Detroit who purchased the wreck for $3,250 with the hopes of raising the vessel. However, he would also fail. $3,200 is a lot of money in 1944.
Yeah, he must have had something good he was going to do with it.
Alas, we will never know. Due to its location, the vessel actually proves to be a really popular diving spot among Chicago area divers. And as early as July 1961, a local newspaper stated,
although the 240-foot vessel has been below the surface for nearly 25 years, the divers are still finding equipment intact.
The article would go on to describe the various tools, personal items that had been found on the wreck. Things like bottles of like hair oil and a comb. Things like it's very interesting. I mean, this was just people's workspace, you know. In the 1970s, many Chicago divers felt that the stern section of the wreck presented a major risk for death, essentially. Like, is what like that group of divers just got together and said, like, this area is too dangerous. Like, people are going to want to go inside it and explore it, and that's how bad things happen. So as a result of this, that portion of the wreck was actually dynamited in order to prevent anyone from entering it. Today, the wreck lies in Indiana waters about 2,000 feet off of Calumet Harbor Light. So really close to shore. I do know that one of the books I used was a dive guide, and it talks about how like turbulent the water can be, how dark it can be. Like, it's definitely a spot where you want to know what you're doing if you're diving on it.
Also, the notes say Indian waters.
I saw that. I saw that. One final bit of weirdness about the vessel. I thought this was a pretty interesting little story. In August of 1936, the buoy, yes, we say it correctly, that marked the wreck disappeared. Almost a year later, that exact buoy was found floating off of Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. There had been four men on the vessel who are from Sturgeon Bay, including the captain, I believe. It's also where the vessel had been built. What's so weird is like there's not an easy way to get to Sturgeon Bay. You can either go around the Door Peninsula.
Yeah.
Or you can take the canal that cuts off the peninsula.
There's not a good way for something to like just accidentally float there.
Yeah. So this buoy floated around for a year and then somehow ended up in this very difficult and hard to get to and specific spot. So I did find that very interesting. It's always fun to find those weird little coincidences and things. One final thing here, a little bit more about Latham Smith and his innovations. In the early 1940s, Smith had a revolutionary idea for standardization of shipping. It would be a uniform-sized container, 7 feet by 9 feet by 7 feet. These could be stacked four high. As well as, you know, you could design ships that would specifically carry these containers. These are both things nowadays we don't even think about. But he's literally designing a system very similar to what we use for shipping containers today.
Yeah, it's like such an integral part of like how stuff gets places now that it's hard to even think about like this being a revolutionary idea. And like I didn't know that like someone had this idea before Malcolm McLean. But at the same time, like we were talking about before the show, like it does seem like a very intuitive step. And it's kind of surprising that it took until what, like 1956, I think.
Yeah.
For that to really be instituted.
Well, and the fact that they thought of these ideas like independently from what we can tell. Yeah, it is an intuitive idea, but also like it took a long time to get that implemented.
I guess part of it would also be, it's kind of like what we talked about with the new unloading system of that was so successful because you didn't have to build a new ship. You could install it on an already built vessel. Whereas like, I guess one of the issues with containerization is that you really can only do this most efficiently on a ship that is custom built to carry containers. And so many of, you know, the freighters at the time wouldn't have been built that way. So I guess it does make sense because even if someone thought it was a good idea, it'd say, well, we have to build all these new ships.
Oh, and not to mention port infrastructure, railroads,
yeah, and drainage, like, you know, the cranes and stuff.
All the other things that go into it.
I guess one other thing I'll add in about the Malcolm McLean thing. And I guess the other revolutionary thing with Malcolm McLean is that like his could basically just be picked up off of a truck and dropped onto a ship, I think is the big thing there. And I don't know that was a factor in Latham's idea.
So a little bit more about Smith. He would actually pass away in 1946 in a shipwreck. You get a little bonus shipwreck here.
Nice.
He was on nice. He was on his sailboat, the Half Moon, returning from a regatta in Marionette, Wisconsin, when a storm on Green Bay would capsize his boat, drowning Smith and three others. So that, yeah, Lake Michigan apparently doesn't give up her dead either. She said, watch this, Lake Superior.
Green Bay, it has said, never gives up her dead.
There you go.
I'm actually, we're going to be going up to Marinette.
Oh, really?
Probably like today or sometime soon.
Oh, nice. Are you guys doing anything specific or just exploring?
Well, specifically, we're going across the river to Michigan because that's where we buy our kratom.
Ah, makes sense.
But yes, got to go through Marinette. It's a cool little towns there. There's Marinette, Wisconsin, and it's right across the river from Menominee, Michigan. And nice.
I don't think I've ever been there.
Going up that way, it takes you past where Peshtigo is.
Well, that is the story of the Material Service, a stinky barge that didn't use hatch covers. Always use hatch covers every time.
Always use the hatch covers.
Like, we give you these things, so you use them. Please do. Be safe. Practice safe transporting. All right, that is our story for the week. We look forward to getting into a more regular schedule. I'm going to watch some trash TV for you people and record another episode about rich people on yachts. And yeah, thanks for listening. We will talk to you next week. Enjoy.